For those of you that don't know me or haven't been in some of my sessions before, my name is Dee Bechtel. And this session is called, What is Birth? When is Death? Has to do with questions of legal medical ethics. But before we start, I put some songbooks out on some chairs for you. I'd like you to turn to page 15 of those songbooks. Familiar tune to most of us. Do you know the tune to that? The words may be slightly different because these are some of the revised hymns in here. Are you familiar with the song, with the tune? Okay, I'll just give us a starting note. Somebody want to play?
Do you want someone to play?
Sure. I was trying this harpsichord out this afternoon. It's not in tune on all the keys, but if you want to...
I'm going to sing. Oh, it's not... Oh, I don't know.
You may decide you don't want to continue. You have the right not to continue if you choose not to.
You've got an excuse if it doesn't sound good.
Particularly the lower registers. The lower registers were the ones that sounded out of tune to me, so maybe if you play with the right hand... Oh, here, this book would be...
Oh, I'll try it, but it doesn't sound right.
This has a spiral bite. There
you go.
You may have to hold it up with one hand.
So
I can't play
it
with both hands
and
hold it up.
I want to sing all three verses.
Yes, let's sing all three verses. Oh, but I can't see it lying that way.
There.
No music stand.
I'll hold it up for you.
Well, maybe.
Earth direct.
Oh, Earth direct.
Anybody who knows
no pedal.
Okay, should we start?
Is there any, no?
No, there's no pedal. It's a harpsichord. It's not a piano. Okay.
Nothing we are God with heart and hands and voice.
Session is throw out a lot of questions that may have not necessarily one answer. I'm not sure any question ever has, well, very few questions ever have only one answer. But these are, I hope there's going to be a lot of discussion. I'll kind of run through the gamut of my series of questions and then throw it out to the ones that you'd like to pick up on. Can you define birth? Can you define what is a mother and what is a father? And how do you know when a person is dead? 50 or even 25 years ago, those were pretty simple questions to answer. Now, because of our increasing technology and a lot of other factors that have changed our lives, I'm not sure we can answer them so easily anymore. Oh, before I get too far into this, I was also asked to announce that the panel tonight at 9 o'clock is going to be kind of a continuation of one aspect of this subject. It's going to be on the subject of euthanasia. And it's going to be a panel between myself, Roger Harms, Darius Larson, and Granger, who and are from our various perspectives on the question of euthanasia. First, if you think about birth, it used to be very simple to define when life begins, when a child was a human being. That was when the child appeared through a birth canal and was able to sustain life on his or her own. Now, it's much more difficult because of our increasing technology. And there are some folks who contend that life begins at the moment when the egg is fertilized, and we should protect that life from that point on. I'm sure some of you may have been reading in the papers recently about frozen embryos, and the question becomes, is a frozen embryo a human being? Does it deserve to have that life sustained even when parents have died? And in this case, as you may have read in the paper, the two parents who produced, well, I guess there's some question about if the father really produced the sperm that made those human embryos. That may be a question that may still need to be decided somewhere, probably in the courts. But at any rate, when the parents are dead, what happens then to these embryos that may have been frozen? Can we allow those to die? Can we throw them on a garbage heap somewhere? Or do they have life? Is that life that we need to protect? The same could be asked of in vitro fertilization, an egg which is fertilized in a test tube. Is that a human being? Can that life be ended? Or does that human being have rights if it is a human being? All of these have become really pretty difficult questions. Because of these medical advances, also, then we get into the question about who are parents? When an egg and a sperm are united in a test tube, is it the people that are the producers of that egg and that sperm who are the parents? Not necessarily always, because we have situations where a fertilized egg has been implanted in a womb of a person who didn't produce either the egg or the sperm, and then the child has grown to maturity and been born in a host uterus. Some of the legal questions that would surround that may be, when that child is born from that host uterus, do the people who produce the egg and the sperm need to adopt the child, or is that child legally theirs? Some of the legal questions that were in the frozen embryo case arose because apparently the people who produced the egg and the sperm, or at least the egg, had a lot of money. And so then there's always a lawyer out there who's looking for a fee, and some lawyer is representing a child somewhere that said, this is the heir to those millions, this other child. Those frozen embryos are not heirs. It's a good question. I'm sure, again, probably it will need to be decided in the courts, but then that brings us to the question, are the courts the proper place to decide those kinds of questions? Do judges have some knowledge that makes them able to decide those kinds of questions, or are they really philosophical or theological questions? In those cases of in vitro fertilization or surrogate motherhood, I would guess there needs to be some sort, now I haven't handled one of these personally, but I would guess there needs to be some sort of a contract by the people who produce the egg and the sperm with the person with the uterus that they're using, rent a uterus, if you will, they need to decide then under what conditions that is their child or is not their child. There was one of these cases, I believe, that I read about, I don't know, a year or so ago, I guess, that where the child was born handicapped, and suddenly no one wanted to claim that child. That was nobody's baby, as far as most of the people involved with the situation were concerned, because suddenly the child was less than perfect, and the people who had intended to claim that child originally decided, no, they didn't want to claim it. And then the question would become, even if there were a contract between the producers of the egg and the sperm as to the fact that they were parents, would that be binding? Can you make a binding contract that says who is a child or whether a child belongs to you other than an adoption procedure? I'm not sure. All of this makes me strongly suspect that we're closer to Orwell's 1984 than I'd like to consider. I see some things in Orwell's 1984 that talk about control by somebody, Big Brother or whatever you want to call him, that is somebody making decisions for us that really should be very much our own personal, ethical, philosophical, legal, or theological questions. And again, I'm not sure a judge is the person that I would want making those kinds of decisions for me. I think these kinds of technology bring us closer to having the ability to breed humans like we breed other animals for specific characteristics. And then the question becomes, do we want to breed in superior intelligence? Do we want to breed in superior artistic ability? What are the qualities that we want to encourage in this breeding? Or do we want to really breed humans at all? Which gets to be a little scary. And who decides if we really can control, if you can plan a child, drop a blueprint for a child, and say, we want this child to have this color hair and this color eyes, and these kinds of traits, then aren't we really very close to having someone else make decisions for us that we ought not to be making for ourselves? The question of transplants gets kind of Orwellian in a bit too. If we take a heart, either an artificial machine that's been manufactured by somebody, or a heart out of a living human being and transplant it into another person, does somehow the donor of the heart continue to live in the second person, in the donee of the heart? You get down to a question about what is a human being. Sometimes, well, ancient literature probably referred to the heart, maybe not necessarily thinking of the organ of the heart as we know it now, but the heart as the spirit or the soul of a person. If we can transplant a heart, are we transplanting the soul or the spirit of a person? Interesting question. And I have no doubt that we may sometime in the not too far distant future be able to transplant brains, or pieces of brains at least. If you transplant a brain from one person to another, then who is continuing living? Is it the donee or the donor? And does that person really have the mind of the donee or the donor? Again, we get into the question about what is the mind. And it almost seems to come down to the question about, is the person a collection of organs that can be interchangeable parts? Or is the person something different than that? And how can we define what a person is? When we deal with the question of death, as far as I know at the moment, a legal definition of what death is in the medical field is that when there is a cessation of brain function. Now, it used to be very simple to decide when a person died, of course. A person died when they were no longer breathing and their vital functions were not functioning. But now we have machines that do all that for us. This is part of the question that we'll get into at 9 o'clock with the panel, but I just wanted to kind of briefly touch on it now. Who decides when it is that you die? Am I able to decide for myself when I should die? That is, can I decide for myself? I can, in most states now, decide that I don't want my body to be hooked up to machines to sustain my bodily functions when I am really dead, as far as my personal definition would be. I don't want to be kept alive mainly to sustain bodily functions. But we get into the question then of who decides, who has the right to decide when I die. And if I am not able, if my brain has ceased functioning, or if I am somehow incapacitated so that someone can at least contend that I don't have the capacity to make that decision for myself, then who else does? I know in at least one state, I believe it was Michigan, where a bill was proposed in the state legislature. As far as I know, it did not pass, but the intent of the bill was that a person should be allowed to designate one other person whose judgment they trusted, who could make that decision for them if the person were incapacitated. In other words, I could designate somebody whose judgment I trusted to make that decision whether or not I should be hooked up to life-sustaining machines or not, or when the plug should be pulled. Again, the question becomes, do we have the right or do we have the power to say that somebody else can make that decision for us? And if I don't have the power to make that decision for myself, and I can't designate someone else to do it, basically the decision is left up to the doctor. And do I really want the doctor to be the person to make that decision? Again, that's the kinds of things that we'll be hitting from the doctor's and the pastor's point of view at 9 o'clock. The question about death also gets us into an interesting question that Roger Harms raised in one of our discussions in preparing for the 9 o'clock panel. That is the situation where if a woman is pregnant and she is reasonably close to the time when the child could survive outside of her body, but the woman dies, or the woman is only sustained on life support systems. And so then you get into a situation where you are basically, there's no brain activity, so the woman, in a legal sense, is dead, but you keep her alive on life-sustaining systems in order for her to be a living incubation system for her child, in order that her child can come as close to normal gestation period as possible so that you can save the life of that child, then who decides when you should pull the plug on that woman or on life-sustaining systems for that woman? And the question becomes even more complicated then if there is not a father of the child involved. If, for example, she's divorced, or if the father is unknown, as in some situations where there are unmarried pregnancies and those kinds of things, who decides? Who decides where that child should go? And you get back to the question about then who has the power to decide whose child or who belongs to a child or who is the parent of a child. And the scary part, as far as I'm concerned, in this whole question about life-sustaining machines is, what is life? Am I really living when I am on those life-sustaining machines? Or are those machines somehow living for me? And if so, is that what I want? Is that life as far as I'm concerned? So you get into questions of quality of life versus just simply bodily existence. And I'm not sure, again, that other people have the right to make those decisions for me. I'm not sure I want them to make those decisions for me. Those kinds of things, those kinds of questions also lead us into the situation of a person's right to die, which has also been raised in some well-publicized cases that have been around our nation. For instance, a quadriplegic who needed to be have that person's life sustained, I believe it was a woman, by other people. She was saying, I don't want you to sustain my life. I want you to starve me to death, or I want you to allow me to starve myself to death. And she was refusing food and being force-fed, et cetera, by court order, I believe, for a while. However, there was another case that I read about in the paper where a retired college professor had had a stroke and was in a nursing home, and a court somehow, I'm not sure who actually brought the question into the courts, but a court decided that this person did have the right to starve himself to death. And he basically was allowed to starve himself to death in this nursing home under supervision. He stopped eating, and within, I'm not sure how long, but at any rate, he died by his own choice. Which brings you to the question of, what is suicide? Did that man have the right to do that? It seems like the courts were saying, or at least the court that was involved with the quadriplegic's case, were saying that that person didn't have the right to starve to death. The court was sustaining her life against her will. In the case of the old man, the retired college professor, and somehow I suspect that maybe the status of this person really made a difference. Is it okay to sustain the life of a college professor, but not to sustain the life of a quadriplegic? And are we making values then about who has more right to live, or who should be forced to live and who should not, on the basis of how we feel about the status of those people? Which becomes an interesting question then about the quality of one life as measured against another. And again, who has the right to make that decision? As I said before, I'm not sure there are not any easy answers, and maybe there may be no answers, no final answers to any of this, because our medical technology is going to keep on advancing, I assume. And the scary thing, I guess, is the fact that more and more of us are personally involved with some of these situations. So now I'd like to open it up to you. Having asked all the questions, do you have questions of your own, or do you have answers? I don't think that question has been decided. I guess in theory, if those people have the legal capacity to contract, that is, they know what they're doing when they enter into that contract, and it's a validly drawn contract that they signed, I would guess that at least someone would argue that it's going to be legally binding. But as far as I know, there haven't been any court cases that have decided whether or not that kind of a contract is legally binding. My guess is that, yes, it would be legally binding, and whether or not that child was handicapped, or no matter what the condition of that child would belong to the people who contracted to have that child.
Mm-hmm. There's one other question that comes up, and it came to mind when you mentioned about the paraplegic and the college professor, and that is the limited number of hearts available, and so there's two people who need one, and one is the college professor, and one is the whatever might be the other extreme. Who gets it, and why, and how do you decide?
Yeah.
And who decides it?
Right. That question came up, at least in a somewhat different context, I believe, recently, with a child's liver. I think there was a case somewhere on the East Coast where a child had been waiting for a liver transplant, and finally a liver was located, and the child who had originally was the intended donee, the condition of that child was deteriorated so much that the child's parents decided, no, we will let that liver go to someone else. And so that, in that case, that was the decision of those parents. But if you're dealing with adults, then it would be a more difficult question to decide. If the person who was the intended donee of the organ, heart, liver, or whatever, was in such a deteriorated condition that maybe they didn't have the capacity to make a rational decision, then who decides?
Or when does a child have his own attorney and make
that's decisions? Right. That's right. And that's more and more possible. Mm-hmm. Because in some of the cases, well, the baby Jane Doe thing, where the child was born very severely handicapped, there was a, or at least there were groups that were asking to have lawyers appointed to represent the child in that case, and said the child had the right to be represented separately from the child's parents. Ultimately, as far as I understand, it was the parents of that deformed child who made the decision, and apparently the courts upheld them and said, yes, it's the parents that had the right to make that decision, and that there was not a lawyer appointed to represent the child. Yes?
Could you go into the details of that case? I've heard a lot about it in the news, but I don't remember the case itself. And
I don't know a whole lot about it, but my recollection is that the child was born, I believe, with some sort of an open spine condition. It was a very serious deformity, which my understanding was it was not likely that that child would ever live more than a relatively short time. I would guess maybe a max of 1 or 2 years, if then. And again, my recollection is from what I read in the press that it was likely that the child would live in a great deal of pain during whatever that short lifespan was. And it was on the basis of those facts that the parents decided, we don't want this child put on any sort of life-sustaining systems. We think the more humane thing, the more loving thing to do for our child is to allow that child to die as painlessly as possible. But there were groups, Right to Life groups, who were saying, that isn't the correct decision, that we think the fact that this child was born alive means that this child needs to be sustained for however long it's necessary, simply to sustain that life.
What experienced physician would be repulsed by a down baby?
I would say probably about 9 months. I'm
a little biased. Well,
we probably went in last night in the session last night, but my experience is not singular. There seems to be a real bias in the medical community against children with handicaps. And I'm not saying that they're not served, but it's a lot more subtle than that. But I really have a strong feeling that the things that have happened for handicapped people, the laws that have been passed, have come about as a result of advocates who are parents or involved people for those handicapped people, certainly not coming from the medical community. And now it is necessary for the parents of handicapped people to try to train doctors. And I think where that training needs to take place in the medical schools, I think the doctors need to be trained, need to have classes on more than just the clinical problems concerning handicapped people. They need also classes with perhaps parents and professional people coming in and explaining the humanity of these people.
I guess the trouble I have with that is the implication that the curriculum that is taught in medical school teaches you that there isn't a human person.
I won't go so far as to say that.
Well, for someone who's experienced it, there was a very strong emphasis and a potential. Let's just hone in on Down syndrome. Who I'm supposed to be so repulsed at, what their potential is. And
I'm really glad to hear that, and I don't know when you went to medical school either, but I would expect that it's a lot better now than it was 10, 15 years ago.
Well, I can't say that I know what the clinical experience was before I entered the profession by any means, and so I'll admit to ignorance out of use. But what I can say is at this moment, that in my limited experience, as far as that particular anomaly, repulsion is not a common at all reaction to position. It's a common anomaly, is recognized by subtle findings in the nursery, not by gross findings. And certainly the baby has to have been carefully examined before that diagnosis is even made. And so, you know, we're not talking about a human being that doesn't look like a human being or any other, you know, the implication that repulsion leads to.
It's a pretty strong word, and
yeah.
And I guess I've had experiences where I almost felt that word applied, but I certainly wouldn't indicate that it's the case with all physicians, but I still would say that from our experience in the medical community that there is a definite bias. Our little girl had open heart surgery when she was nearly three, and they were telling me at the medical school, this was in Portland, Oregon, that there was a time when open heart surgery wasn't even done down here, because again, with that same kind of thing, you know, that there might be some thing that they either, well, to put us behind, let's say that they couldn't survive it. And they found out after they started doing it, when they looked at their statistics, that 3 out of 10 normal children were dying in the open heart surgery, and 1 out of 10 down here were dying. This is kind of an aside, but they are real hard children.
Roger, could I ask you when it was that you went to med school, and where in your med school training, like was it early on in med school itself, or was it after you had more specialization training that you got this kind of training specifically with reference to Down's kids?
Well, specifically with reference to that, my first exposure was in pre-medical school genetics class that was required by my particular medical school to go in.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, in the second year medical school curriculum, in a growth and development type of class. Thirdly, in pediatrics, my clinical rotation as a junior, where I took care of 2 or 3 Down syndrome babies who were having heart surgery.
And all of those things are, at least the ones you've mentioned up till now, are the ones that are required of all doctors then, before you get into the specialization?
Right. Up to this is a required rotation. And again, I can't say my experience is as great, or my research is great, as someone who has experienced this firsthand. You know, obviously,
mm-hmm.
I'm seeing what my personal experience has been,
sure.
And not what a broad base of history of medical practice for Down syndrome is. So I would have to back off on that. But and it may be by the efforts of parents that has been changed. But by the time I came through, starting in 73 through 76, in medical school, we had a rather definite discussion of the potential of Down syndrome babies as it comes up not only in pediatrics, but also in terms of genetic amniocentesis and in the obstetrics point of view of it. It's very difficult to go through medicine now and not discuss this issue. You have to at least discuss it.
I think that your recent education
is
helpful.
Yeah.
That's
real
good.
Good.
Did you say that I thought I heard you say that the soul resides in the heart?
Well, ancient literature used to tell us that. I'm not sure anyone has been that bold to make that statement in recent years, because there are things like heart transplants and so forth, you know. And I don't know of anyone writing currently that defines a particular place where the soul resides. But, you know, I'm just saying that used to be the concept.
Do you think there's anything in the Bible that makes reference to what you're talking about? Such as perhaps that which is born of the flesh is flesh, and that which is born of the spirit is spirit.
Mm.
And
yeah.
There is a good deal of psychic information that indicates that the soul enters the body at birth.
Mm.
But the soul also knows which body it's going to enter. It chooses. This goes along with the idea that each of us, you lived previous lives. We are back and forth.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so that view then would say that, would be contradicted by some of those folks who say that from the moment of fertilization of the egg, or in some cases from the moment of implantation of the egg into the uterus, life begins.
That is just flesh. According to that,
okay.
To this type
yeah,
of information,
right. Uh-huh.
That is strictly flesh, and it's not a, as
mm-hmm.
we say, a living human being,
mm-hmm.
not until the soul enters.
Mm-hmm.
But that, this, again, this is there's a considerable body of psychic information along this line, but it all depends on how much validity you put on it.
That's right. That's true of any of these questions, I think, yes.
I just read the other day that the ancient Jews believed that the life was in the blood, which is why they insisted that the blood had to be removed from the animal, because the life was in the blood.
Hmm.
That's the whole theory behind blood sacrifice, is
mm-hmm.
that the life mm-hmm. had to be shed in a propitiatory way,
mm-hmm.
in propitiation. And the animal was, the blood of the animal was shed instead of the blood of the person, the life of the person.
Hmm. So that, I assume, would be the basis then of the kosher laws that are still existing in Orthodox Judaism now, whereby animals have to be slaughtered in a particular way in order for them to be edible.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, in that case, then, if the life is in the blood, then whenever we give blood to someone, then we're giving them our life, huh? Or part of ourself. Yeah.
And that is why blood transfusion, for instance, for Jehovah's Witnesses, is a violation of God's law, because the Old Testament indicates we are not supposed to ingest blood, and transfusion is the ingestion of blood.
Hmm. Oh, that's interesting. I never did know the basis for that
mm-hmm.
belief of the Jehovah's Witnesses, but I know that's their belief.
Well, along that same line, there's also a body of psychic information that indicates that Atlantis really existed, and that it was destroyed over a period of thousands of years in three different stages, and that the basis of the destruction was that these people were violating God's natural laws through genetic engineering and by misuse of what we call nuclear power. Again,
hmm.
this is all psychic information, whether you want to believe it or not, but it touches along the line of some of the things we're doing.
Right.
I have to find out where the psychic information comes from. I have to find out where the psychic information comes from. Is this printed word or out of
the
air? The
information I've read is all an organization called the Association for Research and Enlightenment in Virginia Beach, Virginia.
ARE.
The organization has been in existence for about 50 years.
And is it based on research then that this organization has done?
It's based on psychic readings given by a man named Edgar Cayce, who died in 1945.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Isn't there also some theological argument that there is no distinction between body and soul?
The separation of body and soul is very Greek. We sort of incorporated that into our Christianity, it started in Greece, and I think actually Christians don't separate to that extent. The body and the soul are one.
Mm-hmm.
You don't treat the soul, you treat the body. And so, but the Africans are interesting. They instead of saying I love you with all my heart, they say I love you with my liver.
The liver is the
life-giving organ.
Huh.
It's like a greeting. It says the soul resides in the liver. Kind of interesting. You said that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, the person head has a blood transfusion inside his body. Then, I mean, his blood, you know.
Right, right. If I have a blood transfusion, I would guess I'm getting somebody else's blood. And according to someone's belief, then, I would be getting someone else's self. That's right, that's right. I become someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know who, huh? Yes. Right.
See, basically, what bothers me about the total question is that I think in this country we are putting far too much into the courts to decide. You know, we try to legislate morals and everything else. It's never worked, it never will. And we are burdening our courts with moral questions that we should decide elsewhere.
Right. Right. I really agree.
But what is elsewhere if two people who have a vested interest in situations disagree? Then you have to have a judge. It doesn't have to necessarily be a judge in the court of law of the state of Washington or the United States. But whether it's a panel of ministers or what it is, it's judgment.
Someone needs to
decide.
So long as
two people disagree.
And there are more and more, in terms of how you decide, at least legal questions or what have been considered legal questions in the past, there are more and more alternatives being set up. For instance, people draw contracts. This is really common in labor negotiations field, whereby the two parties making the contract decide that not a judge in a court of law will be the ultimate arbiter, but that there will be arbitration or there will be mediation, which is a different process altogether, to make the decision. And so there are some situations that are now arising within the legal system whereby we say we don't want a judge, as we normally think of now judges in the court system, to decide. We're agreeing in this contract that someone else will have the power to decide. And so that could easily be written into some of these contracts whereby you contract for rent a uterus or whatever in order to decide, you know, a minister or a panel of ministers could decide, or, you know, you could designate a group of people to make a decision in case of a conflict.
It's still a judgment.
That's right. It is still a judgment. And it is still a final, someone has to decide.
All it accomplishes is unburden the backlog of the cases
That's
in
right.
our courts.
That's right.
Still a judgment,
That's right.
not necessarily a better judgment.
No, but then I guess it comes to the question about better according to whom.
This reminds me of Alexander Pope. He says, "'Tis with our judgments as with our watches. None go alike, yet each believes his own."
Very good. Other questions, comments?
Don't we say that we are body, mind, and spirit, and this is a trinity similar to Father, Son, and Holy Spirit? And I have read that body, mind, and spirit, and mind is a part of spirit or soul, but mind is a mediator between the body and the spirit or the soul. When death comes, the body is sloughed off in the shell. The mind, which is your personality, moves on into the soul, the spirit, and wherever we go, which we don't know. And that is sort of a theory that I accept about who I really am.
And so that theory would say then that the mind is what makes you who you really are rather than your spirit? Is that what you're saying?
It's a mediator between the body and the way it functions and the living spirit or soul that God gave you.
Okay.
Is there a scriptural basis for that? I'm not a theologian, but I question whether that is necessarily a Christian position.
Saint Augustine took the view that his whole argument is one of analogy by which one can logically progress by the understanding of sign. That is why sign and symbol are such words that make Lutherans shiver. But by his understanding of sign, it's a two-level thing, and the second level always becomes the first level again. And you are, by this way, he establishes an analogy from his anthropology to his theology, making a nice match between a triune God and a sort of triune man.
Not to cast aspersions on Augustine, but I think he was the one who mentioned that the soul comes into the male fetus at 29 days and the female fetus at 39
days. There's a whole lot of what's called Trinitarian speculation in Augustine, but there he's being controlled by his philosophy rather than by what he found in Scripture.
this business about when the soul comes into the fetus is also an interesting question. I think that some of us don't realize, in terms of the abortion question, it used to be that we only knew life began. A woman knew that there was life inside her, usually, or at least in terms of the legal aspect of that, was when you felt quickening, when you could feel movement of the child. And so up until that point, or when that was the definition of when life began, then you could abort a child, a fetus, before you felt life. Now we have much more scientific and much more sophisticated ways of determining that there is a living creature, at least, or a living fetus inside, and so therefore some of our definitions about when abortion is okay or when it is not okay have been changed because of the increase of technology.
Well, sometimes in places the decision has been based upon it could be aborted up to the time where the body could, where the fetus could survive outside of the mother's body.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's right. That has been part of that legal definition as well, too. And in the legal context, as far as I know, I believe I'm correct in saying this, that for instance, things like inheritance rights are not now vestable until the child can sustain life outside the mother's body. For instance, if both pregnant mother and child were killed in an auto accident, put it the other way, if mother was killed in an auto accident but gestation was far enough along that child could survive then by emergency C-section or whatever, that child would have inheritance rights. But that definition then would contradict what's now trying to be claimed for those frozen embryos, because that certainly doesn't fit within that legal definition.
I haven't been around a newspaper lately. What was the frozen embryo?
Oh, okay. The situation was that there was a married couple who apparently were unable to conceive a child and bear a child in the usual way, and so they had gone, I believe, to a doctor in Australia, is my recollection, and that doctor, I assume, took several eggs from the mother and several sperm from the father. There's some question about whether those sperm now really came from the father or not, but that's another side issue. Assuming that both the egg and the sperm came from these two married people, they were united, I guess, in vitro or in the test tube in some way, and frozen. There were at least, I believe, two other fertilized eggs that were frozen, kind of for future reference, and one was implanted in the uterus of the woman that belonged to the married couple. That apparently didn't work, and the egg, I don't know, there was some problem with it, and apparently it was, she miscarried, I believe. And sometime after that, then, fairly recently, the two parents died in a plane crash. But the doctor in Australia, if that's where it was left with at least two other frozen embryos, frozen implanted eggs, fertilized eggs, fertilized eggs. And the question is, what do we do with those? Do we implant them in someone else's uterus and let that child come to life and inherit millions, yes, or do we, you know, offer them to someone else, or, you know, are those frozen embryos heirs then? That becomes the main point. It probably wouldn't have hit the papers quite in such a spectacular way if there weren't millions of dollars of an inheritance to be involved.
Heirs of those who died, is that what you're saying?
Yes. Yes, the people who were killed in the plane crash were wealthy. Yes.
There was a particular case, a child aborted, emerged alive, mm-hmm. and was then set aside to die. What protections of law are available to such a child?
If the child survived, I assume that child was still a child of those parents. again, as far as I know, that case has not been decided, that situation has not been decided in the courts, but the theory would be that even though that child had attempted to be aborted by, I assume, the mother, and perhaps by the mother and father jointly, that would still be a child of those parents, and those parents would be the people that would have the right to decide what happened to that child. Was it given up for adoption, or were they forced to raise it? And there have been questions similar to that in terms of wrongful life suits. There have been suits brought for wrongful life by people representing, for instance, a handicapped child whom the parents would have desired to abort, you know, and those kinds of things. As far as I know, that kind of a cause of action has not succeeded anywhere, but I think it's been attempted in courts.
It has succeeded.
Oh, it has?
I am pretty sure that it has succeeded in regard to someone not informing a patient of the right of genetic
amniocentesis. Oh, I see. Oh, okay.
And then they subsequently delivered a child that was handicapped by a condition that could have been detected by that, and the doctor was held for damages of having not informed them of that possibility.
Hmm.
There was one in the paper just recently where they were suing the doctor because they had asked about that. She was over 35 and said, you know, shouldn't I have this test of the embryonic fluid? And he didn't think it was necessary, and the child was born handicapped. But I haven't seen the results of that suit as yet, how it was determined in the courts.
But apparently, as far as you're saying, Roger, then that those kinds of suits have won then, and they have gotten damages from the doctor in those kind of cases?
So that from a medical legal point of view, you have almost no choice but to make that procedure known and available. You don't have to push it by any means, but you do have to make it available.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which is also another reason why doctors' medical malpractice fees are so astronomical. You know, obviously if doctors are open to those sorts of liabilities, they and frequently are. Well, we are getting very close to 8:00. Thank you for coming. I hope this at least raises some questions.